Chilpak Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
You never know when an episode is just going to end up being torturous. Hi, everybody. This is your Chilpak Hollywood Hour in Los Angeles. I'm Phil Lairness. And over there in Sydney, Australia, this is the star of the show, Mr. Dean Haglund. Hello, Dean.
Star of the show? Hardly. We are co-hosts, my friend, co-producers, though you're producing most of this these days.
I'm doing a little bit of the heavy lifting right now, although, you know, we're both going to be taken to the open road soon enough. Plans to meet up there in Dallas at the end of May, and we'll do a session from there. But I'm hoping that when we have the bugs all out, by the end of May, you know, using this handy Zoom recorder to record the media, I was realizing that if I just bring the mixing board, the Zoom recorder, and all our stings on like my iPod, then, you know, we could do these shows fairly easy on the road, you know, knock on a glass Formica tabletop, which is what I've got in front of me.
Right.
And then we level it, we get it up, and all is good. So I have high hopes that even when I'm on the road for 4 weeks driving more than 10,000 miles throughout the U.S., we'll be able to continue this. Yeah, a lot going on. A big trip, which I love, as you know, but equal parts shooting.
See America.
Shooting Truth is out there, too. Equal parts film festivals for the Lady Killers and many weddings. So.
Oh, is it that time?
I guess
all the friends getting married.
I guess it's that time. I don't know. It's actually they're all in the. In the ladies' family, don't you know? So.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, as my dad said, who's in his 80s now, it goes, first you attend all their weddings, then you attend kids' birthdays, then you attend the divorce parties, then you attend the retirement parties, and then you attend their funerals. So you see the same people every sort of 10 years, but
I feel like maybe things are a little bit different in Canada than they are in Los Angeles because... In L.A., and this is going to sound like a joke because I have that tone of voice, but you know that this is actually true. It's just funny that it's true, but there's second and third weddings in there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because
maybe it's the...
you got to trade in for the younger model when you get to a certain age.
I know, but you stop going to those weddings. I mean,
you kind of do. You kind of do. You know, actually, once I read the blitz on that here in L.A., I have turned down weddings. This is my hand to God. This is true. I have turned down attending weddings and have told the person involved, you know, my friend, I'll go to your next one.
And that's right. I'll catch the next one.
And I've always lived up to that. I've always gone to the next one. Yeah, that
right, because there's always the next one.
That one doesn't last either, but what are you going to do? This is your Chilpak Hollywood Hour. We have a lot to discuss. I'm hoping I can actually remember to dial up an email that we got about last week. But just before we started recording, I was sharing with you that I've been watching the Larry Sanders Show again. It kind of started for me on the one-year anniversary of Gary's death. And
right.
But it also.
And you brought it up because you said applesauce.
Yeah. Yeah. As a test thing. During the opening credits of the early seasons of Larry Sanders' Show, Hank would be warming up the crowd. And see that sign up there? It says applesauce. No. It says applause. But it was interesting because it all dovetailed at the same time where actually what I'd been watching was the British The Office again.
Yeah.
And I went through all of that, including the Christmas special, which was a movie here. And it then I was reminded just that so much of that, by Ricky Gervais's own acknowledgement, was inspired by the Larry Sanders Show. The kind of acting and the kind of comedy was really inspired by that. So that that led me right back into Larry Sanders. And your question about how does it hold up? You know, in some ways it's better. In some ways it's au courant because of how it influenced everything. And whereas some comedy, like you and I have said, if you go a couple generations beyond the academic appreciation of it that we might have, sometimes it's you understand right. It may not be funny for contemporary audiences. But Gary Shandling really wanted the truth. And I was reminded of something that happened this weekend. I taught an acting intensive, and there was this scene that was just terrific from this play that was written in 91 called The Baby Dance. And the actresses were really rolling up their sleeves and doing some really courageous work, for lack of a better word. And what was fantastic was by the fifth take or so, I was reminded, oh yeah, this is a comedy. And I loved that we all misplaced that. We all put that in our back pocket. We all forgot about that. Because what makes the Larry Sanders Show hold up so damn well is this belief that some performers have, that when you're playing drama, you play it straight. And when you're playing comedy, you play it even more straight. You play it even more real.
Right.
You make the stakes even higher. Right. You don't go for the laughs. You go for more pain, more drama, more truth. And you'll still get the laughs. You'll just get the laughs maybe in a different place. So
it's so true. Think of Carol O'Connor in All in the Family. That guy never laughed or cracked a smile once in the entire 8-9 seasons of All in the Family.
Right.
And everything was deadly serious to that guy. And one of the funniest sitcoms ever done. And you think, how did that actor never break up? Never. There was nothing funny ever in any of those episodes. And yet it was the highest rated sitcom and groundbreaking of all time, like Larry Sanders.
You know, we've talked about this before, about how can you imagine what Seinfeld would have been like if Jerry was the equal as an actor to Michael Richards, to Jason Alexander, especially to Jason Alexander and... Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Yeah. Can you imagine if Jerry was the... He didn't have to be for how that was structured.
He didn't have to be.
Of course. But really, he's there's quite a few seasons in there where he's no actor at all, really. And I suddenly realized in watching one of these Larry Sanders, you don't have to imagine what it would be like. It would be like the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because Gary Gary is kind of playing a version of himself, certainly playing a version that a character near him that he knows well, and an occupation he knows well, but he is every bit the actor that Rip Torn and Jeffrey Tambor are, and it's actually taken me this long to really realize that. He's both holding center and the straight man. And he's every bit the actor they are.
Amazing, right? It's quite a lesson.
I saw a movie.
I just think it was HBO's lowest.
So it was low rated, but it also, let's face it, established them. It took them seriously in terms of suddenly when all these awards, nominations, and then wins for Larry Sanders' Show, anytime HBO would submit a series for award consideration, it's taken seriously from that point forward.
Oh, that's true. Good point.
So it did elevate them. It It's interesting to still see the words home box office at the beginning of the show, though, because I really want to bring that back, HBO's home box office. And for a whole generation that's never been to the movies, what's a box office? Anyway, I saw a movie I wasn't actually going to talk about because there's so much other things that I wanted to discuss with you. But I suddenly realized it came up in a meeting today with a distributor about the next film I'm going to make, a thing called Night Falls Fast, about a theater troupe and what happens when a member of that theater troupe commits suicide. But I saw a movie recently that came up because of it as an example that we might want to look at in terms of distribution strategies and release strategies. And it was a movie that focuses on an improv sketch troupe called Don't Think Twice. And it came out in theaters a year ago. It was written and directed, and one of the stars, Mike Birbiglia. And it's about what happens when one of the improv troupe makes it big to a show that looks and sounds a lot like Saturday Night Live, but is called Weekend Live. And that person is played,
that's different.
That person's played by Keegan-Michael Key. So it's what happens to this, but it's also, if I can say, I'm not sure metaphor is the right word, maybe paradigm is better, but along with our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, it is really one of only two films I've ever seen that touches on this idea that improv as a paradigm for living makes a great deal of sense.
Right. The living in the now, the present, to say yes to everything, all of these
teamwork, constant teamwork, trying to plug listening. In your unique excellence into building something with other people.
Right.
But
all of this.
The thing that I can't believe, though, because people keep asking me, what was that movie? What was that movie? And I mentioned the movie, and they don't know the movie. And, you know, and it, boy, it's amazing that a movie about improv could have such an awful title as Don't Think Twice. I think you could probably grasp what the message behind the rule Don't Think Twice is where improv is concerned.
Right.
Right? Don't second guess.
Yeah, you don't second.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't filter your ideas. Like, let that.
But
let the first idea be the idea.
Yeah. How in the name of hell did they not call the movie Yes and ...
or No Blocking, No Wimpy. I don't know.
But like yes, other, yes, and people would remember. People would remember the title Yes and. And that's and that's the first rule they give. And it's you know, and it's something that even comes up in the movie when they're fighting. Stop yes anding me in the middle of fights, you know. so anyway,
that's funny.
But I'd be curious. I'd be curious as to what you think if you track this movie down. Don't Think Twice, because it's surprisingly beautiful. It's surprisingly beautiful. This movie.
Is it?
I'll say that. I mean, at times it's artificial. I mean, it's kind of got both the strengths and the flaws that a night of improv might.
Exactly.
But when it's truthful, its beauty is almost unparalleled. And I think that's probably true for when in the middle of improv, people strike upon something really profoundly truthful.
Right. Yes, that's absolutely true. And, you know, it requires trust and everything to get to, which I think, you know, one would hope that the body of work, like why, when you name an improv troupe, Stan gets a sore toe or whatever, you think, well, they'll get past that when they see the actual work we're doing. And then you go, no, you got a dumb name for an improv troupe. So, you know, one would think, the name doesn't matter, but I guess in marketing terms, it does.
Well, that's interesting. The name that they have is a great one, I think, for their improv troupe. And I wish I could remember the name of the comedy school that sponsors them. And it's a comedy school that they're...
Okay. let's table this because I got to see this whole thing now.
This is definitely
on the front of my list.
Mike Birbiglia, who wrote and directed it, his character is a teacher at this comedy school. You know, he teaches improv, introductory improv, and he's a member of the founding member of this. But their sketch comedy team is called the Commune, and what I love about it is it's not a bad name for. An improv team. I love that they avoided the need to make it be a funny name for the purposes of the movie, you know, to use the opportunity as a gag, which I feel like would be a Christopher Guest kind of approach to it, to make the team be funny because it's an opportunity. But like I said, I really think they're using this as a paradigm for how life could be lived and these characters, if they could maybe... Maybe I'm reading too much into it. You tell me. But I feel like part of this is if these characters in their own way could more use the paradigm that they've been using so effectively on stage in their own lives, they would be so much happier. And so this name Commune, has multiple connotations. Anyway, let's move on, shall we?
Shall we? Let's do that.
Do you? How about we talk about a couple of things following up on recent episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour? A couple of weeks ago, we did a report on the world premiere of The Lady Killers, a little movie we produced together to act in. And of course, directed, wrote.
You did?
I shared with you how that night went. But what I haven't had a chance to share with you is... First of all, one of the reviews that came out following, we had one review prior to that premiere, and one review...
Yeah, you said one was stellar.
And one following, which was just stellar. It's from Richard Propst, the independent critic. He wrote, "The Lady Killers is a demented piece of dark comedy, the kind of comedy that's so dark that you don't know if you should laugh, cry, shudder, or just plain look over your shoulder."
Wow, that's so true. And that's how I felt looking at it just in the editing room.
Oh man, you know, so a couple of film critics that I invited who are friends of ours, I'm not going to mention them because that would defeat the point, but I didn't want them writing reviews partly because, you know, they're friends and I wanted their feedback more and to help, how do we position this with critics? Plus, I wanted to know that they liked it and how they felt before I asked them to write a review. Anyway, and one of these critics saw a test cut of the film and gave me a lot of notes. And after seeing the premiere, loved it, thinks it's perfectly paced. The other critic said, "That movie is brutal. I feel beat up. It is so dark. It is so dark." And then the first critic looked at him and said, "That's not dark at all." So I love this. I love that we've made something. But you're absolutely right. Like when you said you were sitting there, we had a preview screening. I don't know if I told you this, but a week before the premiere, we had a preview screening for a small audience to get, you know, demographic and marketing audience research stuff. And
In Malibu.
And at one point, I could not walk. I just could not watch this movie. And I look at Bert, who's like a row in front of me, and he's staring straight up at the ceiling, like, "Oh my God, what hell have I wrought?" Right? And so then I just need to connect with one of the team. So then I look a couple seats over, and there's Lily, and she's sitting on the edge of her seat, staring at the screen with a wide grin on her face. And I look at her like, "What the hell?" And she says to me, "I love this movie."
Oh my God. And was there audible gasps in the audience?
So here's the interesting thing about it on our early demographic stuff and everything. Women have given this thing an average of 9.2 on a scale of 10.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, if women can be, if they can be convinced to see this, if they can make it through, apparently they end up loving this movie. Here's another quote from the review I want to share with you. Basically he's saying, if you know my work, you know that Lernis isn't a guy who's afraid to dabble within the darkest corners of the human mind. Yet he does so with a... Yet he does so with a refreshing authenticity and a sense of humor that would likely seem surprising if much of his work wasn't actually comedy. I love
wow.
that. Yeah,
well, that's true, aren't you? You're dark. I mean, I still laugh at the time you and I are walking around your neighborhood. You go, "Oh, this is the house that I'm going to hang myself in."
Well, I just said this would be the perfect house to hang myself in. I didn't mean that I was going to.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's just that, yeah, I do think about it. If you're going to do it, you want to know where.
Yeah, right. So you sort of plan that out. That's pretty dark, isn't it?
Oh, my God. I hope that this clip never ends up getting played at one of my memorials. One of my memorials. Here I'm going to have multiple
one
because
of them.
They're just going to be... That got dark. That got even darker.
Internet.
Darker. I like this, and I'll stop there, although, come on, you know that nobody reads reviews of my movies better than me. The Lady Killers... is a comedy, at times an outrageous comedy, yet it's also in true Lairdness fashion that the film points the camera back at Hollywood's easy exploitation of women and, I dare say, the ways in which we as audience members easily surrender to being entertained by the exploitation of others.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Doesn't this dovetail into our conversation about Manet, of all things, the week after?
So did you see that we got a very interesting email in response to that?
No.
Before we go to that, Art and Manet, and don't let us forget
okay.
this,
right.
We also wanted to share this. Our very own Jamie Kaler won Best Actor. For his work in The Lady
yes.
Killers at this festival.
Isn't that amazing?
And
yes,
it was so
we're
touching.
We're now an award-winning film.
We're an award-winning film, yeah. And it was so touching because it really mattered to him. It really meant a lot. You know, I mean, he's accomplished a great deal as an actor. He's had his own sitcom. He's been in some big movies. And he, you know, he hosts shows on television. He has a career not dissimilar to yours, Dean. And so maybe mm-hmm. you can... relate to this in that it never occurred to him on the path he was setting out on, which is comedy. And his is sketch more than improv, but sketch comedy and stand-up, mm-hmm. written stand-up, but then sitcom and this. It never occurred to him in setting on that path that he'd ever be in a position where his acting would ever get an award, because it always seemed to him... that's for dramatic actors. That's for people who take a different path, not for people who are willing to be identified with comedy.
Yeah, and that's so true, because often, you know, comedians, sketch comics are not seen as serious actors, particularly if you're pursuing stand-up as well. You know, often stand-up gets acting work, but rarely, you know, do they get awards for that acting work. There's a handful that I can name, but that's about it. So, yeah, it was a big deal. I personally sent him a private email congratulating him.
I think it's well-deserved.
You know, set the accolades.
I really think it's well-deserved. I've been associated with movies that have won some awards at festivals and other things in the past. And I got to tell you, honestly, my hand to God, this is not only the most joyous I felt about any award that a film of mine, including ones I've won, not only the most joyous I felt about an award, but it's the most joy I've experienced. Joy. I've experienced other profound emotions relating to movies that we've done, but it's the most joy I've experienced since the Directors Guild screening of Karl Rove, I Love You. It was him winning Best Actor because I just think he does so much heavy lifting. He's the connective tissue in a film that easily could seem like a series of short films where all these different characters are the lead, you know, where different characters
Absolutely.
Take turn
yeah.
being the lead. But he's the connective tissue, and he does so much heavy lifting. And I also love it because he truly is a character that a lot of people absolutely despise through the whole film. And for someone to play someone that an audience authentically despises and for that person to get honored for that is really cool. It's the kind of thing that gives me hope, you know, that we're not just giving awards to the characters we like the most.
Well, exactly. So there we go. Another emotion of joy.
Once every decade.
Realized.
Yeah, once Hooray! Every decade, I get a moment of joy surrounding my work.
Right.
You know, you don't
to keep you out of that window that you're going to buy.
Wait a minute. Oh, my God. That's inappropriate.
Oh, is?
You know, speaking of inappropriate laughter, but we will get to Manet and Art in a second, but we're talking about comics and comedy and so much of this and actors that maybe we ought to do the big celebrity death this week.
Celebrity deaths.
If I were to say, Dean, that to me, as a stand-up comic, Don Rickles was a great actor, would that make sense to you?
Yes, though that sounds like you're diminishing his acting work, which it's as a stand-up, he's a great actor. Yeah, because it was a character that he did. You know, when you realize or saw him live or knew him, we're talking about Don Rickles, of course, that a lot of his, hey, your puts and, you know, Jew with this and whatever, that all he could do because he was such a nice guy, so charming, and didn't believe that wasn't in his heart at all.
Yeah, it was an era where many of these guys, right, many of these comics were playing characters.
Yes.
And but it was a true kind of acting rather than character work, you know, like I don't know how to describe it, but we've had comics of recent vintage that were characters, but I wouldn't go so far as to call it acting. I would call it more performance art or you know,
right,
character work. But
like
but Don Rickles on stage was to me kind of like Cary Grant in the movies, in that you could easily think there's no acting here, right? It's just Cary Grant
right,
being Cary Grant. But Cary Grant created a character that he then brought to each movie and would riff on that. And Don Rickles really, through many years, created a character that had a life of its own on stage that people began to think of as a real person.
Right, and that's where you get into the term persona, that you develop a personhood that is slightly different than yourselves, a persona that isn't quite a character, not so far removed from yourself, a la Australian comedy legend Dame Edna, who's, you know, a 70-year-old man, but comes across as a fantastic...
But see, to me, that's still a character rather than a persona, because... Yeah. I think you have to be able to believe the persona is the real thing. And nobody believes... If they believe Dame Edna is the real thing, they might need help.
Okay, bad example.
Yeah.
Let's see. Bobcat Goldthwait? I'm trying to think, where would be that dividing line, you know, between character, show character, and persona, and then...
But
just personhood.
But Don Rickles is that. I mean, because, you know,
I know, right?
His comedy, his humor in personal relationships and personal life was supposedly so warm. You know, it's like, it's so funny, the ironic nickname Mr. Warmth. But he really was supposed to be the warmest guy imaginable.
Yeah, exactly.
Our friend Peter Shinkoda paid homage to him, said he used to make deliveries to Rickles' house twice a month. During the 90s when he was a delivery boy. And he said Don Rickles would always make him feel like the most important person in the world. He would always sign for the delivery himself,
really?
Would always give him a big tip, would always joke around with him, and always would make him feel like $1 million. And that's just Pete sharing this, but this is the story that I hear again and again and again. I mean, he was a real...
I saw him live in Vegas, actually. 99, around there. And what a show. So this is like probably one of his last headlining appearances in Vegas before, I don't know how many more he did. But he definitely, to me was the most amazing thing was there's a opening singing act. And then it said, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Mr. Warmth himself, Don Rickles. And then the spotlight just turns to the second row. And there he's been sitting watching the opening act. He hasn't even been in his dressing room. Hasn't been like thinking, rehearsing, hasn't been talking with his managers or anything like that. He's been enjoying the show with his wife, Barbara, right in the front row. And then he just gets up from his seat and walks on stage and grabs the microphone. It was like that effortless to do then an hour and a half show in front of 800 to 1,000 people in one of the main rooms and just kill it. And, you know, by that time, he was laying off the where you're from and who and what the hell. And he had more songs and stories. And it was really not just entertaining, but so personable. It was an amazing show. And then afterwards, he just stepped off the stage and sat back in the audience with, you know, and just got like it was nothing. Like it was just, oh, you know, something to do. For an hour and a half in the evening.
I mean, it's almost like what was funny was the contrast between the warmth and the energy he embodied and the meanness of the words he was saying. Like, that contrast was right. What made it funny.
Exactly. Yeah, that you knew that there was no teeth behind coming out of any other comic. Hey, you're an idiot, you're putz, whatever. All of that would have come across as so vicious. And, you know, it would have sent chills down audiences' spine. But because somehow he, you knew that was coming from a calculated as opposed from an internal screwed up emotional score. That you could laugh at that contrast.
He was, you know, he really was an actor. I, like you said, I didn't want it to sound like I was diminishing his work as an actor. I wanted. Hopefully, I made clear by now that, you know, his to see his acting in movies and shows as somehow separate from the acting he was doing on stage, I don't think is fair, because I think he was very much, very much an actor all the time. And
right.
It's just that he may never have gotten the role in movies and television as great as the role he got on stage under the name Don Rickles. But some big movies, right? Supporting turns in Run Silent, Run Deep. Kelly's Heroes.
Yep.
He's funny and good and believable in those. And then, of course, he had his sitcom CPO Sharky, which I actually got kind of a kick out of when I was a kid.
Oh, did you? I never actually watched it, but I remember it for sure.
What turned me on to it was when he would appear in the 70s on The Carson Show. And how about those panel appearances on The Carson Show? He was acting with Johnny. They were basically sketches. And they were acting. It was terrific.
Yeah, with like moments of seemingly improv, but then you knew somehow maybe they were going to discuss. And the classic moment where he was doing a thing with, I think it was Bob Newhart guest hosting, and he broke Johnny's cigarette case, his cigarette case on his desk that had been there for 30 years. And then the next night, Johnny came on and go, what the hell happened to my cigarette case? And went on to the CPO Sharky stage next door and confronted Rickles about the whole thing.
He was also, of course, for an entire generation or more, maybe now even almost two generations of filmgoers, I guess. That's how long we've been with the Pixar movies. He's been Mr. Potato Head.
I know. Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah.
That's a great gig, too.
Yeah. And it's great so casting. Funny. It's great casting for him.
It's true.
Don Rickles, this also gave me pause. Born 1 month, well, not 4 weeks, exactly 4 weeks prior to my father in Queens. My dad was born in Brooklyn in June. He was born in May of 1926 in Queens. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, my dad always was a big Don Rickles fan, and it gives me gives me pause. Anyway, I'll finally get to see my dad. I haven't seen him this year. I'll finally get to see him first week of May. So,
oh, there you go. Part of your road trip. Fantastic.
A little warm-up road trip. Little warm-up. You know, you can't just... You got to get into training, right? So you can't just go 10,000 miles. You got to go 1,000 miles. And so drive up.
You got to sit on your...
see the folks. Take my sister to Stanford Medical Center for some tests. You know, hit all the hot spots.
Right.
And then come back.
Hit all the hot spots. Because you can't just sit on your ass for 10,000 miles. You have
here's
to sit on your ass and get up a bit.
Here's how out of practice I am for this. Because it's been since, I think, like September, since doing a San Simeon and San Francisco trip and, you know, the California coast. I was supposed to go to Palm Springs for a little bit of a trek the week before our preview screening. And we got back from the Breakfast Club, all ready to pack up. Let's hit the road. And, oh, wait a minute, we have a cat. How did we not think about this?
Oh,
so
you've totally neglected Fuzz Aldrin.
So apparently, I was not supposed to go, and indeed, it then turned out that had to redo entirely the DVD screeners for our preview screening anyway. So I wasn't supposed to go. It all works out for a reason. But yeah, that's out of practice.
Right.
What have I forgot? I feel like there's something I've forgotten.
Oh, a life form that needs feeding and taken care of.
Whoops.
Oh, yeah.
You would think. That was not good. All right. Here's the email we received. Hey, guys.
Okay.
Thanks for taking me down memory lane to my artsy roots tonight. And by the way, she spells... I think it's she. I hope it's she. I'm sorry if it's not. Anyway, I haven't gotten to the bottom of the email yet. Anyway, but it's but tonight. I just wanted to point out that tonight is spelled T-O-N-I-T-E. So indeed, the artsy roots have been reconnected with. A lot
artsy tonight.
Of the artists you mentioned are on my top 10 list also.
Mm-hmm.
Dean.
Oh, good.
Dean... Oh. It makes total sense that Van Gogh was poisoned by his own paints. One of the reasons I switched from art to music was to avoid getting poisoned by all the paint thinners I was using in display art. In addition, did you know Van Gogh loved to drink absinthe, which can also make you go crazy?
Well, yes, back in that day, they were still made with the wormwood. And, it was known. And so I'm sure that didn't help matters if you're ingesting highly toxic paints and then screwing up your liver with absinthe. That would be a double combo.
See, so absinthe is supposed to make the heart grow fonder, but instead it can lead to madness. Remember the movie Madam X? It is rumored that all those swirly motifs in his paintings, e.g. Starry Night, were a halo effect he saw after one too many absinthes. I was lucky to see a Van Gogh exhibit in Toronto many years ago at the AGO, at the AGO. Do we know this place, Dean?
Yes, the AGO. Yes, it's the Art Gallery of Ontario.
Oh, very nice. What did Dean win? Can we tell him what he wants? Phil.
No, I've been there numerous times. It's lovely.
Phil, did you know that Picasso parodied other artists, including Manet? So here's the Manet reference, right? So he parodied other artists, including Manet. The painting you were referring to by Manet was called Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe. L'Herbe? L'Herbe. Was parodied by Picasso. See, I did not know.
I did not know that.
Picasso even would parody himself. Now, this I knew. This I knew. And the question, if, and again, I'm no art scholar. I just know what I like. But unless I am very much mistaken, there was this period of time where a lot of critics would say that Picasso had become a parody of himself, and there was truth in that, only what was being overlooked was how much of it was a conscious parody on the part of Picasso. Am I remembering this correctly?
There was a turn, I guess, let's say 70s, I'm going to say, that the critics, as one, you know, each generation of art comes up and shuns previous art choices for the new and all of that sort of thing. Modernity's constant march forward. It seemed that Picasso had become a parody of himself, but then to get ahead of his critics, actually parodied himself to show the difference between what is a pursuit of an artistic vision, personal, and what is a parody. So it became sort of this multi-leveled art critic, artist conversation going on through his work in a period there, for sure.
Almost like this is not a pipe.
Kind of
calling a question to it, being the object, the painter, and the critic all in one, is an interesting interesting thing.
And also then pulling the rug out from under your critics, so therefore you are technically critic proof, which you know, then gets to ego based whatever.
Wow.
You know awesome. One does that.
And here's the thing: why I brought up, why it made me think of the Magritte is because it's so necessary to have a sense of humor if you're going to do this. If you're going to attempt that kind of, I don't know, paradigm shift within your own work, you know, to hold the conversation from multiple perspectives yourself, you have to have a sense of humor, right? Oh, I mean, almost like improv, right?
It's true. Almost like improv. Yeah, you have to hold three or four things in your head simultaneously that are seemingly opposite.
Yeah.
A la Schrodinger's cat, right? How do you hold it's dead and alive at the same time?
And as the
seemingly paradoxical.
Our listener points out, the guy had a sense of humor. I was lucky to see an exhibit of his work many years ago in Montreal at the Museum of Fine Arts. Okay. Do we know the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, Dean?
We do, yes. That's lovely.
There is a book of the exhibit that you can get on Amazon. Sadly, I have never seen an exhibit of Salvador Dali. Would love to see his version of the crucifix. I have heard it is stunning. Tell me about this painting, if you would, Dean, the crucifix.
Yes, this is later in his life. He got into religious motifs post-atomic age. The atomic testing really affected him, and he turned his realist brush back to religious themes. And the crucifix is actually seen from the top down. If you can imagine seeing Jesus played from the top down, almost floating in the sky, facing towards the earth, with a lake scene underneath him, and the cross itself is floating blocks, almost like an exploded architectural block grid portion, and it's disconcerting in how its perspective shift makes one almost feel off balance, and at the same time has the surrealist aspect and a realism aspect, but ultimately divinely spiritual. It's quite an amazing painting.
Wow.
Yes.
That sounds like something that really does need to be seen in person. Not like all paintings are meant to be seen in person, but I feel like, again, one of the things we discussed last week, I feel like there's such an energetic component to that work that it's
absolutely
something to be standing in front of it.
Yeah, because so much of his work, I mean, I saw, I forget which one, a Dali's painting at the Chicago Museum of Art. And I've seen it many times in art books and stuff. But what you don't realize is he, in the bottom right corner, painted a black dog against a black background running happily. It's like a little Perth kind of fun terrier dog. But because most of the paintings are saturated for color, it, the bottom right corner always just looked black in any of the art books until you realized he put a little running dog black on black. And so it, unless you were at see that painting in person, you would never know that existed and how that alters the whole meaning of the painting.
I want to, this is the email was signed, Your Loyal Chillbot, Myo, M-Y-O. So thank you for the very thoughtful letter and for sharing some things that I did not know, and I look forward to learning more about. And please, anyone within the sound of my voice, write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We want to talk about what you want us to talk about, especially if we have something to add to the conversation and find it interesting. It's one of the things we mean.
Absolutely.
When we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Before we leave art, though, Dean, you thought of Manet. When I read this quote from the film critic about how our movie points the mirror back at the audience who's watching our movie, bringing to awareness their own complicity in allowing the proliferation of, maybe even causing the proliferation of exploitive imagery. And that made you think of Manet, and I wanted you to elaborate on that, if you would.
Well, we talked about it in the terms of exploitation of the female body and the nude, and how he would play with that in his paintings. And often the nude, her gaze would be directly out at the viewer, challenging the viewer, almost in the Belle Epoque era of Paris, France, to say that you who are here at the salon to look at nudes are doing it, you know, objectifying the woman as opposed to appreciating art. And you are complicit in this triangle,
right?
Insofar as, you know, viewer, viewee, objectification, and, you know, perverse, pure.
Maybe we need to have people, you do a limited series of portraits of the women and the lady killers in a Manet style.
Oh my God, wouldn't that be killer? Holy smokes.
It's actually a great idea. We're going to have to talk about this a little bit. I'm reminded then also of, we talked about it before, that Cindy Sherman exhibit that I saw at the Broad not too long ago, last year sometime, but about the whole idea of the male gaze and how the male gaze has influenced all of photography because men more or less invented the art form of photography in terms of, you know, dominating the way that it was done editorially. And so therefore women learning how to become photographers basically learned it from the point of view of the male gaze, how men look at things. So there is a masculine component to capturing something with a camera. And this is a conversation I really want to have Alana Rain, who remember was co-hosted our Mayan podcastathon with us, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. But I would love to have her back on, because before she was an award-winning filmmaker, she was of course one of the top photographers in the world. And this concept of how do you deconstruct and unlearn everything that you learned because it's a masculine construct. Because it's all easy to say, okay, well, I'm going to shoot it from the female gaze. But if what you learned from the time you took an interest in visual images was to see things as a man would see it, what does it mean then to see it as a woman would see it? And
well, that's exactly the point.
And that's what makes the Cindy Sherman exhibits fascinating, unnerving, funny, refreshing, revolting. I mean, any number of things, you know, but really, but really quite an experience. So there is quite a bit of film development news that caught my attention this week for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, there is no rhyme nor reason in any of these, no pattern to this, unless you are capable of finding one.
Okay.
But something really struck me about how the wait is over and we're finally going to get a movie based on the Disneyland Jungle Cruise ride.
Well, haven't we been waiting for that synergy to take place?
I mean, and a headline in the newspaper, Dwayne Johnson boards the Jungle Cruise. So,
Yeah.
Is that news? How is that news?
Well, Disney's marketing department is stellar. Dave, of course, worked on the X-Files, and now he's head of all marketing for Disney and doing a great job. So I think that's how that's news. And, of course, this is the last of the rides, I think, that are being made into a movie.
I hope.
And vice versa.
Because it's the last of the classic rides.
Every movie's a ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, one would be amiss if,
you know, if they didn't do it, it'd be a crime if they didn't do it. So this, this Dwayne Johnson here, I mean, God bless him. Obviously a smart guy. I mean, boy, what multiple careers he's had, and not a young fella. I mean, I have no idea how old he is, but he's been around a long time when you think about the wrestling career and the acting career going on 20 years now, if not more. But
yeah,
as they pointed out on the Oscars this year, which really, to me, still feels like such a gut punch. Everybody can talk about how awful the moment was when the La La Land producers had to have their Best Picture trophies taken away from them on stage. But I feel like that's less of a kick to the balls than the announcement at the Oscars that Dwayne Johnson is the highest paid actor in the history of movies.
Is that true? I didn't realize that.
Why wouldn't it be? I mean, he is kind of one of the only. I mean, I would never even thought of him as a movie star, but he's almost like a Disney ride himself.
That's so true, right? Yeah, he's a manufactured thing that appeals to the widest range of your demographic, or your core demographic. Like, he is almost what you would think when executives get together going, because remember there was a crisis in and around Triple X and the time of Vin Diesel, and there was just like, they were struggling to find their next action star, that most of your action stars, Schwarzenegger and Stallone, were aging and they couldn't do the stunts anymore, and Harrison Ford, you know, could do one stunt a week. And so,
yeah, but that's when he's behind the wheel of his Cessna.
See what you did? And then, so there was this fear of, okay, well, how are we going to do these tentpole movies if you don't have a brand name to stick up front that is wildly popular, that doesn't get into scandal, that is, you know, talk show ready, and doesn't have to build himself up. I mean, they were trying to go Jason Statham, but that guy had to be in every muscle magazine to show how serious he was at the gym, just so that you could believe him as an action guy. He had the acting chops and the stunt chops, but he was, you know, tiny and wiry. So.
But I love the Schwarzenegger comparison.
Somebody thinks.
I love the Schwarzenegger comparison, Dean, because he does feel bona fide, built in, like ready made action star, and Schwarzenegger did as well, right? I mean, Conan,
right.
And the Terminator, and they found, you know, and that was before Schwarzenegger knew how to act, right? But he was ready made
right.
action figure. But it's almost like Dwayne Johnson looked at Schwarzenegger as a not a role model,
a template,
but a template. Yeah, and said, with the exception of Terminator 2, what is Schwarzenegger's what are his biggest hits? And it's when he became warm and cuddly. Action hero, warm and cuddly, Kindergarten Cop, Twins. Yeah. And
Twins, yeah.
And that's his whole career, is Kindergarten Cop. In a way, I feel like, with Dwayne Johnson.
The same thing, yeah.
So
Yeah, even changing his name. The Rock, too aggressive. We got to go. You got to say Dwayne Johnson. You got to go back to his original name. Like, even that, such a calculated move. Because it's like, no, you can't be The Rock. The Rock sounds like you're, you know, warm enough. So Dwayne, your name doesn't even need changing. So, yeah. So I could see that being the highest paid star. That money has to go somewhere, and it has to go corporate friendly. It can't be someone pursuing an artistic path of any sort. It has to be someone who is in the realm of your four quad, what do you call that again?
The four quadrants, demographic appeal. You know, but what you were also saying about, you know, the dearth of action stars and the crisis in this also explains why Stallone just turned down his first ever upfront payday in excess of $20 million. It was the richest upfront that he ever was offered. Well, I mean, have you seen the Expendables movies? I mean, I don't know.
yes, he's barely making it through that. He's shot up with so much human growth hormone that, and you know, his skin is papery thin from all the whatevers.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe you're on to something.
Do one more.
Maybe you're on to something then, because it was Expendables 4 that he was offered more than $20 million up front for to just act in. He wasn't even going to have to direct this one. And he's turned it down, apparently walked away, although Avi Lerner, with whom he's involved in a couple of disagreements, says that he doesn't think, it's irreconcilable, but we'll see. If you're right, if he doesn't think that he can do it physically anymore, then probably his ego would make him say, just his vanity, that, you know, oh, that fucking producer not agreeing with me about these things, screw it, I don't need it. Whereas in reality, what he doesn't need is to take all those drugs and to go through all that training again. That's got to be punishing at any age, but especially at his age, after all that scar tissue. Because the official story is, interestingly enough, their argument is over, number one, which visual effects house to use, and two, who should direct. But that the visual effects house is the bigger argument, which seems really interesting to me.
That's interesting, yeah. I'm not sure. What is there? Wow.
So anyway, one of the rumors, though, is that instead what Stallone is going to do, because he has been getting a lot of offers in the wake of his Oscar nomination for Creed and the international successes of The Expendables, but that he might do a team-up with Jackie Chan, which is something that should have happened 25 years ago.
So agree with that. Wow. And, that show.
We've been on and off losing you. You've been breaking up a little bit over the last few minutes. I'm not sure if there's something you can do a little differently over there in terms of the microphone or what.
There's not anything, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, we're wrapping it up. There was some news out of the DC Cinematic Universe, the DC Comics Cinematic Universe, which, as you know, I am no fan of Suicide Squad and the Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel. These are some of the worst movies Hollywood has ever produced. I do think that the Wonder Woman, the standalone Wonder Woman period piece, could be something. I have hopes for it. I also got to tell you, the extended universe offering that is Joss Whedon's Batgirl sure makes a lot of sense to me. Joss Whedon, who kind of created the template with his Avengers. DC, if you can't beat them, absolutely pluck them out of the Marvel Universe, pay them more money, and have them do a female-driven action film. Yes.
Yes, totally. A la Buffy. I mean, you know, he did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV series, after the Buffy movie was so screwed up. Like, he was arguing, and they said, shut up, you're the writer. And that was the motivation that he needed to get that to the series. So
Serenity.
So I would think that...
Remember the big screen
Serenity.
Version of Firefly? That becomes a female-driven action film. The action star in that, Summer Glau.
Yeah.
That, and finally injecting humor into Joss Whedon rolling out of bed in the morning is funnier than anything in any of the DC Cinematic Universe movies so far, including Suicide Squad, which was supposed to be funny.
Yep, it's so true.
Finally, last bit of movie development news before we close with what we're reading. I love that for his follow-up to The Big Short, the Oscar-nominated The Big Short, former comic filmmaker par excellence, Adam McKay, is doing a biopic of Dick Cheney. And who is in talks to play the former vice president? Christian Bale.
I can't imagine.
Christian Bale.
What? Oh, my God. Is he going to put on weight in the whole thing?
Well, he did for American Hustle. He transformed himself for American Hustle and was terrific. I love this. I love that kind of casting. Honestly, I think that could be great.
That seems amazing. Yeah, if that works out.
Because it's risky. It's taking chances. I think everybody involved is taking chances. And so that really excites me. Because, you know, biopics often... worry me. I find more and more often there's really, well, look, as we've said, there's very rarely any need for them, because you show me a biopic, I could probably easily dial up on Netflix a far better documentary that involves the real person.
Well, exactly. I know. That's always the problem. You need something more insightful, a la an interesting actor playing the part, more than, you know, a documentary trying to find the hidden truths in stolen moments.
Right, finding some universal truth, allowing us, which a narrative film absolutely should do. A documentary maybe, but a narrative film certainly. If a documentary can be seen as something where you are trying to not only lay out the facts, but understand the facts, let's say,
yeah,
then a narrative film is using the facts, maybe manipulating, reordering, changing, but using the basic factual framework of someone's life, not to help us understand them, to help us understand ourselves. Because that's the purpose, exactly. I think, of narrative storytelling.
And the last one I think that ever came close to that as a biopic was maybe Anthony Hopkins as Richard Nixon in Oliver Stone's Nixon. Maybe there was some universal truth in that.
Maybe.
Because technically Anthony Hopkins looks nothing like Nixon.
Hmm. Well, maybe we can talk about Nixon biopics. We can talk Frost Nixon. We can talk. But I want to talk about... oddly enough, a book that I've been reading that I want to turn into a biopic. What we're reading. I am reading The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. How's that for a spoiler-filled title? The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. It's by Jeff Hobbs, and this is a breathtaking biography of a young man who was a student and a fellow Ivy League student with Jeff Hobbs, with the author. And when he died, while still in college, Jeff Hobbs wanted to tell the story of his life. And he was told by one of the people in the neighborhood, one of the poorest neighborhoods in America, in Orange, New Jersey, East Orange, New Jersey, where Robert Peace grew up.
Mm-hmm.
This man said, if you're going to tell a man's life, you'd better tell all of it. And he tells all of it, everything that he can possibly find, using the people's words, the words of the people who were there. And it's riveting. It's been a long time since I've read. I mean, this is nonfiction, but I feel like I'm reading the best fictional portraits possible of a character. And I say that because in a fictional portrait of a character, everything of that character is available to our narrator, right? If the narrator is omniscient. And
right.
This guy has so done his work that I feel like every part of this young man is available to me. And I'm only, I don't know, I'm not even a fifth of the way into it. And I've got some ideas of who I want to talk to about seeing if we can get this book and try to make this thing into a biopic.
Wow. Look at you go.
So when you're not busy reading about motherboards, what else are you reading, Dean Haglund?
Well, I took that to heart, the criticism. Are we only reading nonfiction? Said one of our listeners a few episodes ago. And I realized that it's true. So I have picked up a novel by Justin Cronin called The Passage, a thriller of a sweeping extravaganza of a novel, says somebody.
Says somebody.
One of the reviews on the back. Who said that? Oh, another author. Jennifer Egan says it's a sweeping extravaganza. So it's called The Passage, and I just cracked the spine of it maybe 2 days ago. I can't tell you much about it other than...
How did it come to you?
Why, it came to me through the community library boxes. There are, as I said, in my neighborhood, as I walked my Doberman through the streets of Newtown, New South Wales, here in Australia, there is a plethora of little... free houses. They're tiny little houses attached to poles that you open up the door, a little plexiglass window in there, and there's a bunch of books left by people, and then you bring some books and instead of throwing them or selling them at a garage sale or leaving them in a cardboard box in the recycling, you put them in this little community library. So you drop a book off and you pick up a book that maybe you might be interested in reading. And so I picked up The Passage by Justin Cronin.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that, especially because it's a neighborhood grab a book, leave a book entry.
Right.
From Sydney, Australia.
I left behind my biopic on Max Sennett called Keystone.
Oh, all right. All about the building of the pipeline. Until next week, you can find every installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour at chilpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review on iTunes. How great is that?
What could be more fun? Like us on Facebook.
Please like us.
Facebook.com/chilpackhollywood. Dean, can people follow us on Twitter and Instagram?
With the same handle. Think of the convenience. Just write out at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and there will be.
Yeah.
And of course, you can email us.
Well, and we've already talked about that.
Yahoo.com.
Yeah.
I know.
So
easy as that.
All that's left is to say until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Yay.
Belated spoiler alert.